If you have your Bibles, we're going to be in two texts. Luke 10, 29 through 32, and then John 9, 1 through 5. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" In reply, Jesus said, "A man was going from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down to the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side." Now, John 9, 1 through 5. As he went along, he saw a blind man from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the works of God might be displayed in him. As long as it is day, we must do the works of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Alexandra Horowitz, in her book, On Looking, A Watcher's Guide to the Art of Observation, says this, "We see, but we do not see. We use our eyes, but our gaze is glancing, frivolously considering its object. We see the signs, but not their meanings. We are blinded, but we are not blinded, but we have blinders." Question I have for you today is this: what do you see? And then secondly, how are you seeing? Jesus previously said in Luke 10, verse 23, "Blessed are the eyes that see what you see." Now, don't think that the disciples were great at this. They had their moments of failing. In John 9, which we just read, we see a text saturated with this idea, with this sense of seeing. As the group sees the blind man, they talk about his sin. They talk about power. If we look at the text, they talk about power. They talk about Jesus' power to perform a miracle. They talk about this idea of political power, that Jesus is trying to subvert them in some way. And we also see them talking about an unclean person as if that person has no value. I mean, they're talking about the guy with the guy right in front of them, but it's if they don't see the guy. And then we notice in John 9 that Jesus steps in, he makes some mud with his hands and a little bit of spit, and in an instant he breaks the cycle. The man can see. Now, everyone looks at Jesus and says, "That's awesome. Great job, Jesus. Now we truly know you're the Son of Man." It's not quite how it worked out, is it? Instead, what we see is this disconnection between how Jesus saw and how the disciples saw, how the Pharisees saw, how even the blind man's parents saw. And in fact, we see at the end of John 9, Jesus say something to the effect of this: "I have come to open eyes to see, but shut those who think they see." And we begin to notice something about this whole idea of seeing, that our eyes become a filter to how we treat people. That our eyes are the starting point, the beginning sense of our reconnectedness to our neighbor. Not only what we see, but how we see matters. So I want to take you to an episode of MASH. Anybody in here ever watch MASH? Okay, good. There are some true believers. MASH is one of my favorite all-time shows, and it's probably for the fact that I can remember as a kid hanging out with my dad at 10:30 and 11 o'clock on Saturday nights watching MASH. That's what we would do at night before we went to bed. Mom would go to bed. Dad, my brother, and I would set up and we'd watch these shows called MASH. And anyway, it's still a phenomenal show. But there's this one episode in which Hawkeye, one of the main characters, loses his eyesight because he's trying to light the stove for some nurses at night. And when he tries to light the stove, it blows up in his face, and he loses his eyesight. And so the whole episode is about how Hawkeye can't see and how Hawkeye is trying to figure out this new way of being in life, that he can't be a surgeon anymore, that he can't really do anything. But through the course of about 30 minutes of the episode, that you begin to notice this change in Hawkeye. And Hawkeye even begins to talk about he's noticing so much more now. He's even becoming a better surgeon, is what he says. When he sits with someone, he notices more of the story and what's going on in their life. And what we began to realize, and what Hawkeye began to realize, was that he had missed an entire world in front of him, and he had 20/20 sight. That brings us to the text of Luke 10. In Luke 10, we can't help but notice that the lawyer can't let Jesus off the hook with his famous, "Now do this and you will live." In fact, we notice that the next thing the lawyer does is he needs to justify himself. So the lawyer does what he needs to do in that moment. He looks for clarification to the boundaries created within neighborly love. The lawyer wants his way of seeing to be validated. And Jesus, being a good Jew, knowing Leviticus 19, should know the parameters by which neighborly love can be practiced in the Jewish society. And while the lawyer might suspect that Jesus has run afoul from this, we can't help but notice that in verse 25 when it says that the lawyer tested him, and then here in a minute that the lawyer needs to justify himself. The lawyer thinks that Jesus should at least know the do's and don'ts of loving your neighbor. And all he can hope is that by asking Jesus the question, that Jesus can hand over a list to him. And it wouldn't be a stretch also to think that the lawyer already had a list in mind of the do's and don'ts. The lawyer had already created his own list of who he can be with and who he can't be with. And the reason for that is, and I think what we see throughout Scripture, is the lawyer already lives in this society that practices exclusion to those who aren't like them, those who are unclean, those who are considered the enemy of God. And we see that in John 9, do we not? Those who are unclean are treated a certain way, are looked at a certain way. They are without value, and they should not be able to partake in the goodness of God. This world that the lawyer lives in, it wasn't created by the lawyer. Sometimes we have to realize that the Pharisees and the lawyers and the scribes and all these people that we see as the bad guys weren't creating something. They were actually living into a narrative that has been written centuries before them. This exclusion that they struggled with and that they lived into was a practice that had started centuries ahead of him or before him. And instead, what we see is that exclusion has been at work in the life of the world from the very beginning of time. So how we see and thereby how we exclude others, even in our own lives today, has been something that has been formed for hundreds of years. And what we notice is that it's continuing to evolve. The names are changing, but it's still there. And in fact, there are new forms of exclusion popping up. But it all comes back to years before us and to a way in which parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and ancestors before us lived and saw the world. They've kind of carried that baggage to us. And so in Luke 10, we notice something. We notice that he wants to justify himself, that the lawyer wants a list. And Jesus gives him a story. Jesus looks at the lawyer and says, "You want a list? I'm going to tell you a story." And in that moment, this story, this parable breaks into the conversation, and it kind of disorients not only the lawyer, but it disorients the crowd. It gives them a new perspective, a new way of seeing. And in fact, the boundaries that were created in that moment that the lawyer was living into, what Jesus says with this parable is, how about I give you a different imagination? How about I show you what else you're missing in this world? You believe that God can only work this far. With this story, I'm going to show you that God wants you to work even further. And so we begin the story of the Good Samaritan with this phrase in verse 30. A man was going down a road. Now, in the Greek, it can actually be parsed out to a certain man was going down the road. But I want you to notice that idea of a man, because we don't know who this guy is. We don't know his ethnicity. We don't know how he spoke. We don't know what social class he is a part of. Questions we ask because Jesus does not define the man at all. And what this does is it holds us in suspense. We're trying to figure out, as we read the Good Samaritan, who the man is who got beat up on the side of the road. And here's the other problem. If we don't know who the man is, then this whole neighbor question gets real blurry, real fast. The do's and don'ts get real blurry, real fast, because now we're trying to figure out who this guy is and the uncertainty of this man. And you can imagine as the crowd is hearing him, the uncertainty of this man creates such a quandary in the story as Jesus progresses, because many may assume that this man is a Jewish man. We think he's a Jewish man because Jesus is talking to a Jewish crowd. But that would be purely conjecture on our part. That would be us kind of just projecting into the story something. Nowhere does Jesus say this. Jesus just says a man was walking down the road. And so we have this ambiguity of the man. Then we have the ambiguity of this half-dead man, which now will cause a struggle for the men who come upon him on the road. By not knowing his ethnicity, the priest and the Levite are caught between a rock and a hard place. Because notice what Jesus says in the story. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away. So now there's an issue for the Levite and the priest, because not only this guy is wearing no identifiable clothes that can help them know what kind of man he is, what kind of person he is. There's all of this is kind of left there. And so by not knowing the ethnicity, it's now up to the priest and the Levi to decide what to do. But this is where we have to remember that this idea of exclusion, this idea of how we see, is something that is part of us, and we carry it with us, because the priest and the Levi are caught up in the religious and social world of their time. And so as they come upon the victim, and here's the big thing, Jesus links, he'll link the three men, but we're looking at these two men. He links the priest and the Levi with this phrase right here. Having saw. Now, we translate it a little bit different in our English, but this is the same Greek word of having saw links both priest and Levi. They see the man, but what do they see? And it will actually be by their actions that will tell us what they see in the wounded man. The question will be, is there a cost to their participation with this victim? And so for the priest, as he sees the victim stripped and half dead, the rule book of the religious system starts going through his head. If this man is a non-Jew, then the choice is easy, right? But we don't know the identity of the victim. We don't know if he's Jew or non-Jew. So the priest has to weigh his options. Is he going to render aid? And the question comes up then, how close to death is he? Or is the man even dead? There is a social status and an economic interest for the priest that comes into question. To give aid to this victim would make him unclean in the eyes of the community. And if he becomes unclean in the eyes of the community, then this will be not only humiliating in front of the entire community, but then he must also go through a ritual purification. And that ritual purification is not cheap. And on a sidebar, I'm just realizing as I'm speaking, I've got a lot of words that are really struggling to say right now. So we'll put that to the side. But ritual purification is not cheap. He would be expected to pay the expense of the purification as well as he would lose any benefit from collecting the tithes of the community. So for the priest, this is an economic thing. For the priest, this is a social standing, but also an economic thing. And so you can imagine what's going the priest's head maybe. Surely the love of God toward neighbor does not cause the loss of status for a man of God. But now we have the Levi. The Levi who is now connected to the priest by seeing. While the Levi doesn't have to worry about defilement, he must deal with the potential embarrassment from the priest. Odds are the Levi knows the priest is ahead of him. And when he sees the man still lying there, the Levi must assume that the priest had a good reason to not do anything. And the last thing the Levi wants to do is lose face in front of the priest by actually helping this man out. So this becomes an honor shame for the Levi. Does the Levi shame the priest by going to the wounded man? Or does the Levi realize and think, well, if the priest, who must have a better interpretation than me, walked on the other side of the road, then maybe I should do the same thing. Both men in this story come. They come by the wounded man. They see, and they move to the other side of the road. Both men bound by the boundaries created and assumed by the world that they live in. They see a particular way. Now, I think most of us in here believe we see just fine. We would never accuse ourselves of missing someone or not seeing someone. But how many times have you been a part of a conversation in which you said, I don't know how I missed that. I didn't see that. I didn't know that about them. Or when you see someone and you immediately move to judgments and you immediately, as you see someone, begin to write a story for them. We might read the parable of the Good Samaritan because we've read it so many times and say, I would never act like the priest or the Levite. But a theologian, Joel Green, reminds us of this when we want to act as if we're not like people of the first century. He tells us this, in the segregation of our lives from others not like us, we are not so far from the people of Luke's world as we might wish to think. In a world in which we live that still has echoes of the priest and the Levite, we too find ourselves connected with the priest and Levi as we see people. The phrase tells us to be prudent with our love towards others. When we see another on the road, we have to weigh our options. Is it worth it? What will the cost be? How will others view me if I do this? And in a moment, when we see an individual, we begin to assign a certain value on them. Depending upon the rating scale that we have set, we'll either say this person is of value or this person isn't of value. And more, we relate with others this way, depending on how the rating scale works out. Miroslav Volf says it this way in his book, Exclusion and Embrace. He says, if others neither have goods we want nor can perform services we need, we make sure that they are at a safe distance and close ourselves off from them so that their emaciated and tortured bodies can make no inordinate claim on us. It is why we cross to the other side of the road when we see a homeless man on the road, on the street. It's why we stare suspiciously, clutching our things a little tighter, because the person walking into the store looks a little different than us, or maybe wearing different clothing than us. We see them, but we don't really see them. We see a threat, a danger, a drag on society, but not a human being. In a moment of seeing, we justify to ourselves and others why this person is no longer a neighbor. And when we do this, when we move to the other side of the road, it is our language, and not only our language, but our body language that will give us away. We do not see the person in front of us as valuable or even human. We see them as something other. And yet, Jesus offers us a story that challenges us to pay attention, that challenges us to notice our blind spots, that challenges us to say, are we seeing like the priest and the Levites? The Good Samaritan causes us to ask a question. How are we seeing? How are we seeing people? How are we seeing those in front of us? Last week I said something that was rightly challenged by a member. I said, our neighbor is those whom you will come in contact with this week. And if we think about it, it's a half-truth. And maybe an easy out, and that's what the member reminded me of. It's kind of an easy out for all of us, because we can control a lot of times who we come in contact with. What I was reminded of is that Jesus, in this part of the Good Samaritan, makes it a whole lot messier for us. Because the issue is, you see every day. You see people every day. Jesus makes it harder by getting rid of the control of contact and making the sense wider to say, how are you seeing all? There's a book written by Angie Thomas, and it's won a lot of prizes, but it's called The Hate U Give. In The Hate U Give, it is about a teenage black girl who lives in the inner city, whose parents are well off, but they still live in the inner city, and her parents, to get her out of the inner city, move her into a private school. Her name is Star. Star has a boyfriend. Her boyfriend's white. Her name is Chris. And Star witnesses one of her friends being shot, makes the news. And in the midst of this, you begin to have this in the book as you read it. You begin to notice the difficulty Star is going through, because the school she's at is predominantly a white school. And so Star at one point is talking to her boyfriend, who is white. And her boyfriend looks at her and goes, Star looks at her boyfriend and says, you're white. And in the book, it's like, it's almost as if he's shocked. He didn't realize that. But he goes, she looks at him and says, that's important. It's important that I see you that way, but also that you see me as a black woman, as a particular black woman with a story, because you have to understand, the life I'm living right now is one in which I realize that people see me in so many different ways. So do I have to be Star, the poor girl from the inner city? Or should I act a certain way so that I can be Star, the upright girl at the Christian school? And it is a private Christian school. But we begin to notice that it's how we see, that people want us to see them, listen to them, hear their story, understand where they come from. That we don't see through them. That we don't write a story for them. But that we actually see them and hear their stories to realize why they are who they are. Because when we do that, Then, as we'll talk about next week, or actually in 2 weeks, we can be the Samaritan. Because the Samaritan sees and is moved with pity. Connected to the other two, but the Samaritan sees on a whole different level. How are you seeing people today? How are you seeing your kids' friends? How are you seeing those people who walk into the store who look different than you and wear different clothes? How are you noticing? What are you noticing? What's going on in your body? Seeing is important. If we're going to love our neighbor, we will have to see differently. We are going to have sanctified eyes. Eyes that are washed in the blood of Jesus. So that we don't see the object of the blind man on the road. But what we see is the value of a human being who needs friendship, who needs love, and does not need another person to write their story for them. We do that enough. It's hard, it's messy, and it's difficult, and that's what makes the Good Samaritan hard. Because it goes beyond contact. It goes another layer ahead and says, how are you seeing? Don't kid yourself. How are you seeing? Because people who see you are noticing how you see them. And sometimes they're trying to conform to how you see them. And that's not what Jesus calls us to be. He calls us to be fully human in who we are. Next week, Justin will be here preaching because I'm going to Colorado to go skiing. So pray for me. If you have a need this morning, come now as we stand and as we sing.